R Sheft, Sheft, at 112 Lexington Avenue, Passaic, Passaic, New Jersey. And we're in the office of Dr. Sheft. He's nice enough to have seen me after he finished his last patient. It's about 10 minutes after 5 p.m., September 16th, 1976. C-A-S-I-M-I-R. And R stands for?
Richard.
And is your father, Dennis, here
no,
also?
He was an artist.
He's an artist?
He's dead. He's been dead 9 years.
And do you know what the zip code here is?
07055.
07055. And his phone number here at his office, area code 201-779-6995. Put those on the tape. If I ever lose my book, I'll be dead without them. I'll just set this here and you'll forget about it after a little while.
Okay, catch your book.
Yes.
Why don't you just tell me what you just told me?
All right. I'll be glad to.
Especially the details around, in great detail, about what you and Josephine, how it all came about and what you remember about it.
Be glad to. All the details that I was told are very, very clear in my mind. It's as if I had been told this story just a week ago or a few days ago, because they've been embedded in my mind. I was so impressed by it. I was a dentist on Saipan Island during the year of 1946. I spent the entire year there. Working for me as a dental assistant was a native girl whose name was Josephine Blanco. Very charming, sweet girl who was learning English at the time, and I helped her to learn English, and she helped me learn a few words of Chamorro. But it happened that one day a colleague of mine and I were discussing the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. When I was a dental student at the University of Maryland in 1944, The Marines and the Army were taking Saipan Island. I remembered reading an article in the paper about either a log book or a photograph album. That I'm not quite sure about. As a student then, I remembered reading about this log book or photograph album of Amelia Earhart that was found on the island of Saipan by the invading Marines. Now, that struck me as rather strange. She had disappeared, Amelia Earhart disappeared on a round-the-world flight in 1937, I understand. And here in 1944, the Marines found a possession of hers, or something that pertained to her. As it turned out, it was a photograph album containing pictures of Amelia Earhart that nobody could identify. Her mother, her husband, nobody had ever seen those pictures before. So, presumably, they were taken by someone else at the time she perhaps disappeared or was kept prisoner or whatever. But nobody could positively identify that album, but they knew there were pictures of her. That was unmistakable. Well, that was ingrained in my mind. Saipan Island was an island I'd never heard of before, but strange as it as fate would have it, just 2 years later, I found myself on Saipan Island. So that one incident, that one occasion where I read about her possession on Saipan Island, interested me, having then been on the island in 1946. I was fascinated, of course, with any old aviator or aviatrix. I'd always had a great interest in flying. I, in fact, had my license to fly in 1940. So I was always interested in anything I could read about the exploits of any aviator. And so that little bit of information was tucked away in my mind. And when I found myself on Saipan Island, I remarked to one of my colleagues that perhaps this island has something to do with the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. Maybe she had been here, or it seems strange that something pertaining to her was found here. Well, Josephine overheard our conversation, and she perked up and got into the conversation, and she said that she remembered when she was a little girl, about 10 years of age, which then took it back to about 1937, roughly. She remembered an American aviatrix and a man who had been circling the island. As I recall, she said the plane was circling the island and there was a lot of activity, a lot of excitement. The Japanese were terribly alarmed and concerned because that island really was off limits to foreign airplanes. Presumably they had something to hide. I don't know whether they were fortifying the island at the time, perhaps, or whatever. That's all speculation. But in any event, as the story goes, they just didn't want their activities to be made known, especially to us, the Americans. As Josephine told me, this plane circled the island, and either she wasn't sure whether it was shot down by the Japanese or whether it just crashed off Tanapag Harbor. She pointed out the exact location to me, which turned out to be the location that where wreckage had been found by Fred Gerner, I guess he was, the fellow who wrote the book, The Search for Amelia Earhart. Well, anyway, I was very interested in this, and Josephine said that she doesn't know what happened to the man, Fred Noonan, who was her navigator. She thinks he was so badly injured in the crash that he might have died, but she did remember seeing the woman who she at first confused for being a man. That is, she thought it was another man because she was dressed in khaki clothes. She described the clothes perfectly, and a short, close-cropped hair, thin person, tall and thin. She described Amelia Earhart perfectly. And here was a girl who had never had any contact with Americans before and should certainly not have known any of these details. She was describing Amelia Earhart perfectly. And she said that the Japs then put her into Garapan Jail, into a little dungeon cell. And she had the opportunity each day to pass by that jail, even though it was within the Japanese compound, the military compound, and natives were normally not permitted in that area. But she had this opportunity because she had a pass from the Japanese military, which enabled her to go through the gate, into the military compound, to deliver a lunch to her brother-in-law, who was employed by the Japanese military as a civilian mechanic, automobile mechanic. And it was her job each day to go and deliver that lunch from the Chelankanoa village over to the motor pool. And this road took her right past Garapan Jail. Now, every day as she passed the jail, she had the opportunity to spend a minute or two. And her curiosity always, of course, got the better of her, and she peered into the window of this dungeon cell and observed this unusual person. She had never seen an American woman before, and she struck up a rather sort of a friendship with her, even though they couldn't understand each other. Josephine then didn't understand English, and certainly if that was Amelia Earhart, who I believe it was, she couldn't speak the native language. So they used sign language, and Amelia Earhart would smile to her and said something, and Josephine smiled back, and so on. It was a friendship without an understanding or without words. But I asked Josephine whether she seemed to be hurt, whether this woman, this prisoner, seemed to be injured. She said no, she didn't seem to be injured, and she spent most of her time sewing or darning her clothes. And this went on, I believe she said, for about 2 weeks. Prisoner was kept in this jail cell. And then one day, when she was approaching the jail on her routine daily trip to the motor pool, she was stopped by Japanese soldiers, and she had to wait. And she saw a procession of Japanese armed soldiers with rifles marching their prisoner, who was in their midst, with her hands tied behind her back. They marched this woman prisoner across the road and down a path, and they disappeared into the woods. Well, she didn't know what was going on, and that path didn't seem to lead anywhere in particular. So then she was allowed to proceed on her way. She kept looking over that way to see if she could see them, but they were out of sight. And then a short time later, just a minute or two later, she heard many shots, she said. There was firing going on, and a sudden burst of gunfire, and then everything was quiet. And that was very unusual. It stopped her in her tracks, and she looked back to see what was going on, because usually there is no gunfire taking place in that Japanese compound. So she stopped and waited and looked back, and then she saw the squad, which most probably was the execution squad, return down the same path they had gone, and without their prisoner. And she never saw Amelia Earhart again. So I presume that that was the site, or that was the execution day, and probably the site of the execution was where that path led. I went down that path, and it traveled about 50 yards or 100 yards, and it ended in a clearing. And that was all there was to it. There were no other road paths out. So I assume that that's where she was shot, if this is all accurate. And that's about all I know about it. The details were told me then. I was just shocked and surprised about it all. I didn't know whether she could possibly have been making this up or dreamed it up, but the details, her description of Amelia Earhart, was so accurate that I couldn't imagine that it was a fantasy of her mind. And I had an occasion to speak to her priest on the island. Josephine was an ardent Catholic, as I recall, and at one time, if I'm not mistaken, she said when she was a little girl she wanted to become a nun. She was a religious girl, and this priest verified that, and I asked him if there's any possible chance that Josephine could have made this up or dreamed it up, and he said no, absolutely none. She's a very religious girl, and she would definitely not lie deliberately. So I just accepted the story for fact. I assumed then that since it had been revealed to me spontaneously, that now the solution to the mystery was solved. And I assumed that the military authorities and the civilian authorities on the island, that is the American military and civilian government, certainly would know the facts about this. There must have been other witnesses to this, and this was now a known fact. So I never did anything about it. I never reported it to anyone else, and finished my tour on the island, returned home, and opened my practice. And years went by. I guess it might have been up around 1960. And I kept seeing stories in the paper and magazines, and saw productions on TV relating to Amelia Earhart's biography and life story and so on. And they all ended the same way, that no one knows whatever became of her since she took off for that last leg of her flight to Howland Island, the leg on which she disappeared, and no one to this day knows what happened to her. Well, this irked me because I knew very well from what I heard on the island that this was her fate, and how was it that no one else knew this? So the straw that broke the back was a TV production. Back in those days, there was a production entitled Omnibus. It was narrated by Spencer Tracy. And it was a one-hour documentary about Amelia Earhart's life. Well, I thought that this story certainly would bring the facts up to date. And I watched it on TV very studiously, and with particular interest in the ending of it. And the way it ended was the same old way. She disappeared, and no one to this day knows what happened to her. Well, that was it. I was just so irked that I wrote a letter to the producer of that program, and I said, I don't understand why you don't put down the end of the story. Why don't you relate to the public what actually happened to her? It's common knowledge on the island of Saipan. There are at least 70 witnesses to this. According to Fred Gerner, he's spoken to many people, and he has affidavits to this. To this effect, that she was there on the island of Saipan and disappeared there. So I got a reply, and he said this is fascinating to him. He wasn't aware that any other facts were known. And he said that he couldn't change the story that was produced, but there is a man who would be interested in this, who was a professor at the Air Force Academy, a Major Paul Briand. He was a professor of English, I believe, at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And he was in the process of writing a story or a biography of Amelia Earhart. Well, he asked me if it would be permissible for him to send my letter to Major Brien. I said, it's perfectly right. I don't care who you send it to. This is news. They're facts. Doesn't matter to me who knows it. So he did. Next thing I knew, I got a call from Major Brien from Colorado Springs, and he was very excited about it. And he wanted to know all the entire story as I just related it. And he put this in his book. He published his book entitled Daughter of the Sky. And he mentioned my story here, the facts as I heard them and as I've just related them. And that's about all I know about it, except that another book was written. Another man got interested after he read Paul Brien's book, and that was Mr. Gerner, who wrote the bestseller, The Search for Amelia Earhart. And I understand that he proceeded to investigate this story, and he went out to Saipan Island. I believe he was a CBS reporter, and he contacted many witnesses, and he has affidavits to this, I understand, that this is really what happened. These people saw her out there, and he, I'm told, recovered a skin diving team under his direction, recovered a generator from some wreckage of an airplane right exactly where the witnesses claimed that her plane, Amelia Earhart's plane, crashed. And this generator was shown to Amelia Earhart's chief mechanic, Paul Mance, and he swore that that was the generator he put in her plane. No Japanese planes had that type of generator, and he said that he could interchange the parts from that generator with those of the generator he has in the replica ship in Lockheed Electra that Amelia Earhart had, and he had the identical same generator put in his plane. So he said the parts are perfectly interchangeable, and he could swear that that's the generator that he put into her plane. So as far as he was concerned, the wreckage of Amelia Earhart's plane was positively located in Tanapag Harbor. This, though, was denied by Bendix Aircraft Corporation. That is, Bendix was the manufacturer of the generator, and they claimed that that was not their generator because it had some Japanese markings on a bearing or bushing that was in the plane, which, of course, does not preclude the fact of if it was her generator. That is no positive evidence that it was not her generator, because certainly a spare part, a new renewal part, could have been placed in that generator to make sure that she would have no difficulty on the long leg across the Pacific. But that's about all I could say about the story. But that's exactly the way it was told to me by Josephine, and this was verified by other people who heard her tell me the story, and other people I queried on this. But they were fearful of revealing this information because I understand that the Japanese threatened them with harm if anyone should reveal this deep, dark secret. But Josephine, probably being a little girl at the time, at 10 years of age when it happened, roughly 10, I guess wasn't too impressed by the threat, and she revealed it. And once the story was told, then the others all concurred in it and said, yes, yes, that's true, that happened. But that's about it, as far as I remember.
Yeah, beautiful. That's amazing, you know. Mm-hmm. Absolutely amazing.
Yes. Well, I assume the government, that's another thing, the government denied that this happened, that that she, well, if there was any foul play, that the Japanese soldiers executed her. Well, this is all, I don't know whether you can call it fact or supposition or what. I'm in no position to say. This is all that's been told to me, so I'm in as much of a quandary about it as anyone else. But it's strange that Amelia Earhart's mother claimed that she felt certain that Amelia Earhart was sent really on a spy mission. Perhaps our government was suspicious that the Japanese were up to something on those islands. They were violating the terms of their acquisition of Saipan Island when they took it over from after the First World War. It had been a German possession, and when Kaiser Wilhelm lost the war, this German island was turned over to the Japanese. But the provisions of that takeover were that the Japanese were never to utilize or use that island in warfare and never fortify it. And presumably they were doing precisely that in 1937. Perhaps they had a long-range plan to go to war with our nation, and they were preparing for that future Pearl Harbor and war with us by putting in big guns and fortifying the island. And perhaps, now this is just, of course, my supposition, my imaginings, but perhaps that they wanted this to be kept secret, naturally, and when they found that there was an American plane circling the island, reconnoitering, taking pictures perhaps, they became very alarmed that their secret would be revealed, and that might have cost them the surprise attack that eventually occurred. So maybe they had no other recourse but to quiet the person who was a witness to this. And that I don't know, but according to the story from the natives there on the island, this is what happened to her. They did kill her. That might have been their reason. I don't know. It's just,
did you ever talk to any of the other natives?
Yes, oh, I did.
Oh, you talked to them?
Oh, yes. I had at least five, six, seven of them tell me this happened. But many of the older ones were very reluctant to admit it. They still had fear because they must have been very, very frightened by the Japanese threat of death if they should ever reveal this. And many of them kept their lips sealed for that reason. But once the facts were out, then they did concur in that. They agreed that that was so. They remember this.
And did any of them tell a like story, elaboration at all, or just concurred, something like that?
Just concurred. Not one disagreed. They said that's exactly what happened. There was not one bit of variance at all. This is exactly what happened. They concurred in it. I never got any different story from anyone. So I had no reason to believe that it didn't happen.
And you talked to five or six different
people? Oh, yes.
Five or six different people. Away from Josephine?
Yes.
As far as you were concerned, you were happy that they were really corroborating her story.
Exactly. I was positive that this was the story because they corroborated it, definitely.
Did you talk to any of the intelligence officers?
No, I didn't. I assumed that they knew it. If I came upon this information so easily, I just assumed that they knew about it. But whether or not they did, I suppose they might have. But when you think of it, why should they have publicized this and perhaps roused up the American public to demand justice be done when we were trying to mend fences and win Japan over to our side and become an ally of ours, which they have been? And I can understand readily why they didn't want to rock the boat and upset this delicate new friendship that was developing by bringing the guilty people to justice. This could go way up high to the top echelon of the Japanese military people. And if the American people demanded that justice be done and we brought the guilty high-ranking Japanese officials to the bar of justice and found them guilty, what would we do? We couldn't execute them because of this, although it was a punishable crime, punishable by death, I guess. It was a murder. If it actually happened, it was a murder of an innocent civilian in peacetime. Uncalled for, of course, in those times. So I think the expediency of the situation would be that out of expediency, the government probably felt it's best to keep the whole thing under wraps. And if she was sent on a spy mission, she died in the service of her nation, and she was an expendable soldier, you might say. And as I say, her mother believes, well, I don't know if she's still alive, but to her dying day, I'm sure she believed that Amelia Earhart was sent on a spy mission. And of course, the government doesn't usually own up to a spy mission. They usually deny it and so on. But I just assume that the officials in Washington, there must be a secret file on this, and all this information is right there in the file, but the government would rather not stir up the embers. That's my assumption. And it's as it should be, I guess. Why rock the boat?
I understand you were, that you ran into a fellow by the name of Harry Manning.
Yes. Admiral Manning was formerly Amelia Earhart's chief radio operator and navigator, I understand. And he happened to be a neighbor of mine in Saddle River. We reside, well, he's dead now, but when he retired, he chose Saddle River, New Jersey, for his residence. And I'm a resident of Saddle River. I've been active, or I had been active, in community affairs in Saddle River. I was on the Board of Education for 6 years, and on the Youth Guidance Council for 5 years, and the Juvenile Conference Committee for 5 years, and active in the Republican Club and so on. Well, at one of the dinners, the Republican Club dinner dance, Admiral Manning happened by chance to be seated right across the table from me, as I recall, or next to me. But in any event, we had the chance to discuss this story, and it was an odd coincidence that Amelia Earhart's former navigator, who really had been scheduled to be her navigator and radio operator on this flight. The flight was, that is, his job, well, let me say this, he was assigned to another job which took precedence over this, since he was actively, he was in the Navy as an active officer. Well, the Navy gave him an assignment which took precedence over this, and therefore, since he didn't have the opportunity to go with her, Amelia Earhart had to seek another navigator and radio operator who happened to be Fred Noonan. Admiral Manning told me that Fred Noonan had practically no knowledge of radio operation. He was very inept at it. Admiral Manning was a very, very competent radio operator and navigator, and he thought that Amelia Earhart made a poor choice when she chose Fred Noonan because he was not really that well qualified to make this flight with her. That was his opinion. But Admiral Manning didn't think that this story that I told could have happened. He was quite skeptical about it and ridiculed it, in fact. But he believed that she just disappeared on this routine flight, and possibly because of navigation error or the electrical storm that they encountered at that time, threw their navigational equipment out of whack, and they just ran out of gas or something of that sort. But it was interesting that I had the opportunity to speak to Admiral Manning, but I couldn't convince him that this story was true. But in my mind, I am positive it's true. There is no doubt in my mind at all that it happened just this way.
Did Admiral Manning have anything to say about Amelia's ability as a radio operator?
She wasn't qualified as a radio operator either, no. That's why she needed an operator and navigator with her, because her ability was not up to it to make this very difficult trans-Pacific flight particularly. No, Fred Noonan was more competent than Amelia Earhart in that particular field, but Admiral Manning said that neither one of them was really that well qualified to make that trip successfully.
I have, I'm only sorry that I didn't get to meet Harry Manning before he died. I guess he just died a couple of years ago.
Yes, he did. A couple of years ago. His wife is still residing in our town.
You
might talk to her.
Over?
Yes,
I would very much like to. And she may have some. He might have written something down or had some papers.
That's right. You might do well to see her about it. But I don't think he knew much about it. Now, if this was really, in effect, or really, in fact, a spy mission, certainly no one else was let in on it but Fred Noonan and Amelia Earhart. I don't think they were allowed to tell anyone else. So Harry Manning probably had no knowledge of this, if it was in fact a spy mission, since he wasn't going to be in on the trip. I doubt if he'd be of any, or his papers, or his wife, or any of that information would be of any use to you.
She still lives in Saddle River?
Yes, to my knowledge she does. Yes, you could call her and find out if she's available tonight. You might see her tonight.
That would be very, very interesting.
She kind of ridicules my story too, and she makes my life a little unpleasant because of Harry's skepticism.
like Harry Truman said.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's extremely interesting. I'd like to ask a few questions.
Surely, I'd be glad to.
One, I take it Josephine was about you were born about 1921, were you?
I was born in 1920.
1920.
Yes.
And so you were just finishing up dental school then in 44.
44. I graduated in 44, yes.
And that was out of the University of Maryland?
Maryland, that's right.
And then you had to go into the Navy.
Right out of school, I went to the Navy. I was in San Diego for 15 months, and then I was assigned to Saipan.
Whereabouts in San Diego were you
based? Boot camp, Naval Training Station. Mm-hmm.
You had a lot of work to do there, didn't you?
Yes, you did. 3,000, all the dentists. I was made supervisor of a dental clinic there, incidentally. It was quite an honor. I was only a JG, out of school for 11 months, and they assigned me to become, they gave me a job of supervision over one of the clinics, which called for a rank, two ranks higher than I held. So I was quite honored to be chosen out of 255 dentists to become a supervisor when I was only a JG.
Excellent. Then you left there in December of 45?
Yes, December of 45. I got there in October of 44, December 45, I went out to Saipan.
And how did you get out to Saipan?
By ship out, and I flew back. Well, I flew back to Pearl Harbor, and then I took a ship.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, you had done some flying in 44.
Yes, I had a pilot's license back.
You had a private pilot's license?
Private pilot's license.
Where'd you fly out?
Caldwell Wright Airport, Charlie White's Flying Service. It was a program sponsored by the government for college students, the Civilian Pilot Training Program, and it was a scholarship type of thing. There were only 10 of us out of the college. I went to the University of Newark at that time, which was affiliated with NYU, and only 10 of us were chosen, or given the scholarship, government expense. We learned to fly. I presume the government was trying to prepare a reserve of, or get college students interested in flying to prepare for the possible future war in 1939, I guess, since Hitler's army was tearing through Poland. I suppose our administration suspected that we would become involved or embroiled in that European war too, so they wanted to get some young college boys interested in flying and perhaps have them enter the Air Force. The other nine who flew with me did proceed on to the secondary course and did go on into the Air Force. I was the only one who didn't, and I didn't because I always had my sights set on dentistry since I was in high school, my sophomore year. I decided to be a dentist, and this to me was just a fun thing because I'd always loved flying. I built model airplanes when I was a youngster, and I just was crazy about flying. So this was an opportunity for me with no strings attached. The primary course had no strings attached, but if I had signed up for the secondary course, then I would be signing up for the Air Force. I never proceeded beyond the primary course.
Did you get married before you?
No, I got married after I came home. I got married in 48.
Mm-hmm. Well, then you arrived by ship in Saipan then, or Guam. And
yes.
You probably went to Guam.
That's right.
And, mm-hmm. Or another small ship or something.
That's how it was.
You arrived there in January then, of 46.
January 46, yes, I did.
You must have spent Christmas on the sea.
That's right, yeah.
That's not much fun.
Wait a minute. Yeah. No, I think I was able to spend Christmas here, and I left the 26th or 27th. They allowed me to spend Christmas at home, and I set out.
Your home here in New Jersey?
Yes, right here in Passaic. I was born in Passaic.
Mm-hmm. My daughter was born in Englewood.
Oh, my goodness.
She still lives in Bergenfield.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you were 26 years old then,
yes.
25, 26. And you've been in the Navy about a year and a half, and you were practicing dentistry for the Navy at where in Saipan?
At the Fleet Dental Clinic.
Fleet Dental Clinic?
Yes, Saipan.
Okay, now that was about in the center of the island, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was on the, I believe it was on the grounds of the Naval Operating Base, NOB, Saipan. I remember that, a Naval Operating Base. Our BOQ was located right at the Naval Operating Base up on the hill. And the Fleet Dental Clinic was down near the shore, but it was still the Navy area.
You compound. Just up a little bit from Tanapeg Harbor.
That's right. Not far from Tanapeg Harbor, right
now,
close to it.
Did you? Josephine was a civilian, and she was hired as...
As a dental assistant. The Navy needed help, so they were hiring the natives to help out in different occupations. And there were two girls in our clinic and several young native boys who worked as laborers, not dental assistants, but as laborers. But the girls were our dental assistants.
And well, did you have to train them from scratch?
Yes.
Or were they sent to Honolulu?
We had to train them from scratch.
Wow.
And it was difficult because there was a little bit of a language problem. They didn't speak English very well, but they were very quick to learn. Josephine was a very bright girl, very, very nice, pleasant girl, and she learned quickly. She is, send my best wishes to her. She was very bright, attractive girl, and willing to learn, and she picked up the work very, very quickly. You had no problem at all teaching her.
Did she work for you almost that whole year while you were there?
I believe so. She was there with me for just about the whole time I was there. I can't recall anybody else who was working for me. No, she was about the only one. Hmm.
Do you remember what part of the year when this conversation took place? Was it towards the first or in the middle or
that
the end? Or?
I can't say for sure, but I think it was toward the end. I would say she'd probably worked for me at least 6 months or 9 months, perhaps, before this occurred, this story was told to me.
Do you remember who you were? Was there anyone else there when she first related this to you? You mentioned you were talking to a colleague of yours.
A colleague of mine, and I think it might have been a fellow by the name of Lou Soma. I don't recall the name. It began with an S, though. I know that.
Was he a dentist?
He was a dentist. I think he was the one I was talking to, or who was in the unit at that time. He was another dentist. I think he was the fellow who was in charge of the Fleet Warehouse. That was one of his extra jobs, and one of my extra jobs. I was put in charge of the officer's mess. I became mess treasurer, and then I also became... mess treasurer and also officer in charge of the officer's club. I had two other spare time jobs.
Josephine said that when the Japanese ran the schools, they used to get off twice a year. They got off 1 month in the middle of winter before finals to study for the final exams. Mm-hmm. And they got off 1 month during the summer period. And this was the Japanese way of school. They went to school 10 months out of the year and they got off 1 month in the summer and 1 month in the middle of winter.
That I wasn't aware of.
Well, what we're trying to do is tie down what month this mm-hmm. occurred. And she knows that it was during one of her summer vacations. She knows it was summertime. It was during this month period that she was off because that's the only time she would be able to go during lunch hour
with
her brother-in-law.
That makes sense, surely.
And I just brought that up. Just threw it out on the floor and see if it meant anything to you. The other thing we're trying to find is a year. Do you have any thoughts on that at all?
Well, this happened in 1946 when Josephine told me the story. And to the best of her recollection, at that point, she was about 10 years old when this incident occurred. So we took it back somewhere, roughly 10 years old. Took it back somewhere around 36 or 37. So in my judgment, it did jive. It didn't mesh.
Mm-hmm. The other thing she's going to find out from her brother-in-law, she's not quite sure when they were married, though she knows they were married at the time, but she's not quite sure when they were married. I have the wedding picture of her brother-in-law and her sister, and she's in it. And she looks considerably older than 10 years old in the wedding picture, but I wouldn't...
Say that her sister was married at that time when this happened? That
yes,
I would doubt.
It was her brother-in-law that she was taking the...
She mentioned her brother-in-law. He was her brother-in-law when she was telling me the story. But she didn't say that he was her brother-in-law back when this incident happened. He might have been a man that was working. In other words, he eventually married her sister, perhaps. I didn't think that her sister had been married at the time, but you see what I mean?
Why did you say that? I was curious.
Well, because if this is the sister that I think it is, I think I met her sister. I met her family. I don't believe she would have been that old to be married, unless she got married very, very young.
Well, she had numbers. She had seven or eight sisters.
I don't know. I only met one of her sisters, I think. So that I can't say. Maybe she had been married, and I don't know.
I know when her brother-in-law came to the island. I shouldn't say I know any of these things. He came as a musician, and in a show that came to the island. And I don't think things worked out too well at the show. They got stranded there, I think. Oh. But anyway, he played for the local theater in Garapan before the mm-hmm. show started.
They're very musically inclined people.
And he also worked part-time for the Japanese, too. Yes. So he had kind of two jobs. And then eventually married the sister. And she related to me, she was married at the time. As a matter of fact, she thinks her sister had her first baby because she remembers taking care of the baby as well. Mm-hmm. But anyway,
I hope
we'll be able to tie the year down by that.
Right.
And then by the vacation, they'd be able to tie the month mm-hmm. up. Then we can go into the records and see if we can come up with something having happened.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the records are so voluminous. If you don't know where to start from, going to start. You see, I have a special problem. Mm-hmm. I can't read Japanese.
It's too bad that Paul Mance is...
I have to hire people mm-hmm. to do this.
Too bad that Paul Mance is dead, because he was very, very adamant about this. He was strong in his conviction.
Did you ever talk to him?
No, I never did. I just read accounts about him in the newspaper. He was killed, I think, filming the Flight of the Phoenix, that picture. It's a pity that he died, because I think he could shed a lot of light on this, certainly. But from what I know is he was convinced that that was her plane, and that was her generator, and that she must have been taken there on the island of Saipan. She must have crashed there.
Did I take a picture of you? I have a very special film. Hoping. Do you have any pictures of Josephine?
I took in those days. Oh, yes.
Oh, I'd love to. Too bad
If I can find them. I can send them on to you.
If
I can find the negatives now, I'm not sure. I might be able to.
I would return them to you immediately. This is a macro lens. I can make copies of anything.
Beautiful.
I think I got enough. Well, hey, you're a good looking guy.
Why, gee.
Believe it or not, that's plenty of light. That's camera always amazing.
Amazing.
I'm going to take a couple.
Mm-hmm. And you don't need a flash. Sure.
It's black and white. I don't have. Oh. Well, that's a little too harsh.
You don't need a flash.
Yeah, no, I like it better off. Moving on to light.
Okay.
Yeah, this is amazing.
What a lens. What is that, a 1.2?
Well, it's not that the lens is all that fast. But what it is, that's really good. I have some real high-speed film in here, and I've done a lot of experimenting with it, and it's supposed to be so grainy, and whatnot, but it really doesn't work that way. It's working out very well. I've got one of those on. Thank you.
That's the story. I can't think of anything else that...
I wished I could tie something together. This is the big problem, is try and tie in
mm-hmm.
her story with other things. The problem is, with this whole Saipan thing, nobody can come up with anything concrete on any end.
You were aware that... Amelia Earhart's close friend, another aviatrix, Jacqueline Cochran, I think was her name, had the opportunity to get into the Imperial Japanese headquarters, I guess it was, right after after we took over Japan and Tokyo, and she saw a file in the Japanese files on Amelia Earhart, but she didn't have the time. This is in one of the books, either in... Mr. Gerner's book or Major Brien's book, I'm not sure which one. But she didn't have the opportunity that particular day to go through the file, but she was fascinated with just the idea that there was a file on Amelia Earhart in the Japanese Imperial Headquarters. So she thought the next day, the following day, she'd have the opportunity to go there and spend more time and go through that entire file to find out what the Japanese had to say about her, what was in that file. And the next day, when she returned, that file vanished, disappeared, and she'd never been able to find it. Well, I assume that the headquarters at that time. The Japanese files were within American hands. They fell to American hands, and I don't think the Japanese officials would have had the opportunity to remove that file. So I presumed that the American authorities removed the file for the sake of keeping this secret. I don't know, unless the Japanese did themselves. But somebody decided that this should not be revealed. And that's interesting, too, and that was in the book. I wasn't aware of that until I read it. But there is some suspicion, at least, as to what the American people have been led to believe and what actually happened. Some doubt about what actually happened to her. I can't think of anything else that would shed any light on this. But this is how it was told to me, and I remember these facts very, very distinctly.
Okay. Well,
another thing that might, well, at least lend some credence to the theory that she was on a spy mission. In one of these books on this story, I read that the engines on her plane were replaced just before taking off for Howland Island, before taking off on the Pacific leg of her flight. Very secretly, I think it was then, or possibly it was even before the beginning of her flight. But anyway, at some time or other, either the beginning of her flight or just before taking off for Howland Island, I read that her 100 horsepower Wasp engines, as I recall, that's what she